Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. COVID-19 infections in Africa have surpassed 500,000, the World Health Organization, WHO, has announced, and there are concerns that a growing number of countries are seeing a sharp rise in infection. To date, the virus has claimed almost 12,000 lives on the continent, more than those who died in the world's worst Ebola outbreak in West Africa, which ended in 2016. Algeria, Egypt, Ghana, Nigeria, and South Africa account for about 71% of COVID-19 cases, while South Africa alone accounts for 43%. In a statement, WHO Director for Africa, Dr. Matshidiso Mwete, said that more than a third of countries in Africa have seen infections double in the past month, increasing the threat of COVID-19 overwhelming fragile health systems. She called on countries to continue to strengthen key public health measures, such as testing, tracing contacts, and isolating cases in a bid to slow down the spread of the virus to a manageable level. Painful and traumatic so-called conversion therapy that's carried out on people to alter their sexual orientation or gender identity should be banned worldwide, a leading rights expert said on Wednesday. Speaking at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, independent expert Victor Madrigal-Bolos said that the practice existed in every corner of the world, even though it had no medical justification. He said that the victims, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans and gender diverse LGBT people, were often left with long-lasting psychological and physical damage. Globally, conversion or reparative therapy is likely happening in at least 68 countries, from Africa to Latin America, the Caribbean and Asia, the Human Rights Council heard. Such practices were driven by the misconception that LGBT persons are somehow inferior, and that this must be remedied at any cost, Mr. Madrigal-Bolos said. Practices detailed by the expert in his latest report include exorcisms by churches or traditional healers in Mozambique and so-called corrective rapes, allegedly arranged by the families of lesbian women. In Ukraine, Mr. Madrigal-Bolos described meeting a gay 16-year-old who said his parents had sent him to a psychologist for treatment and to a priest to express repentance, while also ousting him from the family home. Dismantling such biases and prejudices requires concerted action from states, the medical community, civil society, and faith-based organizations, the independent expert maintained. Finally, women journalists face particular dangers while going about their work, which governments should do more to prevent, the UN Human Rights Council heard on Wednesday. In an appeal to member states, Dubravka Simonovic, Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, said that action was needed now to combat an emerging fundamentalist discourse and a global backlash against women's rights. Since 1992, 96 women journalists have been killed while doing their jobs, the independent expert said, along with the threat of sexual assault and rape to undermine their credibility and discourage them from working. Highlighting increasing online harassment, the rights expert cited a survey by a UK newspaper which showed that of the millions of comments left on its website, 8 of the 10 most abused writers were women. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll learn about a case involving children in the Democratic Republic of Congo who are being maimed and killed in dangerous cobalt mines. As most of the world relies on lithium-ion batteries using cobalt in their personal devices, the plight and injuries of these children, who earn about a dollar a day, is surely one of our untold tragedies.
We speak with Black Agenda Report editor Glenn Ford about the mass movement that's unfolded, first against police abuse, but then every question of society inequality opens itself up. Where are we going?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Tech giants Apple, Google, Microsoft, Tesla, and Dell aided and abetted in the death and serious injury of child laborers working in African cobalt mines. That's the claim put forth in a class action lawsuit filed in Washington, D.C. by international rights advocates. Cobalt is used in the lithium-ion batteries that run smartphones, laptop computers, and electric cars. For the past several years, production of cobalt has increased threefold. The Democratic Republic of Congo produces over 60% of the world's cobalt. It's a nation that has been torn apart by civil war and remains one of the poorest countries on the planet. There, young children are forced to work full-time in highly dangerous mining jobs for less than a dollar a day, often because their parents were killed or incapacitated by cobalt mining themselves. These miners are regularly maimed and killed by tunnel collapses and other known hazards common to cobalt mining. Joining us to talk about this is distinguished human rights attorney Terence Collingsworth. On behalf of Burmese victims of forced labor, Terence initiated the landmark case under the Alien Tort Statute, seeking to hold UNOCAL liable for human rights violations occurring during the construction of its gas pipeline in Burma. He filed similar cases against Coca-Cola for allowing the murder and torture of trade union leaders at its bottling plants in Colombia, and against ExxonMobil for human rights violations of its military security forces in Indonesia. Terence was also instrumental in establishing the Rugmark program, a unique system of certifying that hand-knotted carpets are not made with child labor, that also sponsors educational programs for former child workers. Terry, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here and to speak to your audience.
Terry, cobalt was once deemed basically a worthless chemical. What has changed, and how has that change impacted human exposure?
Well, the big change was that the tech companies discovered that cobalt was a key ingredient to what they developed as a lithium-ion battery. And cobalt is an essential ingredient. It's what keeps the cathode from overheating and catching fire, and it also allows the battery to store more. So they suddenly decided that it had a value, and about two-thirds of the world's cobalt is in the DRC. So suddenly the DRC, which has a horrible history of being exploited by outsiders, suddenly finds itself as the headquarters for this run on cobalt, and all of the giant tech companies need it, and they're there buying it.
Give us a sense, if you will, of how many children approximately are involved in mining cobalt in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The best estimates that I've seen, including from Amnesty International and some groups that are on the ground like AfriWatch, are that at any given time there are about 40,000 to 50,000 children mining cobalt. And that is probably conservative because these areas are very well guarded. It's hard to get in and really document, but it strikes me that that's probably about right.
And talk, if you will, about what long-term, well, not long-term exposure, I guess, where the injuries come from collapses of mines and other related injuries and deaths. How are they injured and how do they die?
Yes. Well, first of all, to pick up on your first point, the International Labor Organization has in fact said that mining cobalt and breathing the dust that has numerous chemicals in it is itself unhealthy. But that's the least of the worries of these child miners, because they're going into these mines. And let me just paint a picture of what it's like. These are sort of mountains of shale-like rock. So it's a soft rock. It's crusty. It's brittle. And the kids have no protective gear at all. And there are some adults, too. There's children and adults. They have no protective equipment. They don't even have proper shoes. And they have a shovel, and they're digging into the side of this soft rock shale mountain. And they're getting farther and farther in and down deeper, sometimes 30, 40 meters. And then the tunnel collapses. There's no support beams. There's no protection whatsoever. And this happens routinely. The question that is asked of these children is not, are you going to get injured? It's, when are you going to get injured? And then, are you going to be killed when the mine collapses, or are you going to be maimed for life? Because these are not minor injuries. You get trapped by tons of rock, and it either is going to kill you or it's going to maim you for life. Most of the clients I have in the DRC who were not killed are paralyzed from the waist down. They've had legs crushed, legs amputated. It's a horrible thing, and often they don't even recover the bodies. I've interviewed several moms who didn't get the body of their child back who died in a mine. And this happens routinely. Again, estimates are that thousands of children have died these horrible deaths. That's a hard number to document because there are no official reports. The companies are not letting people in to inspect. So that's a tragedy that we don't know the entire scope of.
Terry, you just mentioned the companies aren't letting inspectors in. Are we talking the actual tech companies, or are there third parties involved in this?
There are two giant mining companies, Glencore, which is a Swiss-based corporation, and a Chinese company called Huayu. And both of them are dominant in the cobalt mining areas. And so they are the ones that are running the mines and keeping people out. They have security, and they're making it very difficult for anyone to really find out what's going on. Each of the tech companies is buying from one or both of these giant companies. They have themselves, the right to go visit the sites. They're major customers, but to date, we've seen no evidence that they're concerned at all about what's going on.
Are there supervisors of any sort in the mines?
There are supervisors. The way these mines are set up is that the parts of the landmass that is a cobalt area are accessible and suitable for heavy mining machinery. They go in, you know, with the classic bulldozers and backhoes, and they're doing a more industrial mine. And then another part of it is not suitable for industrial mining, so they just open it up. And then kids and some adults come in and mine in those areas that are still within the company property. They're called artisanal miners, which makes it sound better, I suppose. But they're artisanal miners, and they are not being supervised by like a safety person. They are looked after by people we call labor brokers, who gather up kids and bring them there and show them where to work and then buy their cobalt from them and cheat them when they buy it from them because they are underweighing it and claiming that it's of poor quality, which was a very common complaint. The kids are getting paid $1 a day at most to risk their lives, and then they're getting cheated from what should be their fair pay after risking their lives. So that's a big concern there as well.
Terry, let's talk about the lawsuit. Who are the plaintiffs in the class action?
I went to the DRC for this case in September of last year, 2019, and I had an advanced team on the ground knowing that I was coming and what I was looking for. What I instructed that I was looking for were either children who were injured or the parents of children who were killed in mining accidents where they could identify the mines and that those mines they could identify were within either the Huaye or Glencore operations so that we had traceability and responsibility back to these big companies. So when I went there, and I'll never forget this, because I've been doing human rights work for 37 years. I've seen everything you can imagine in terms of exploitation, children chained to looms in India. But when I went to the DRC, I wasn't ready for what I saw, which was I was presented with literally a parade of maimed children. They could not afford like crutches or wheelchairs, so there's this group of kids waiting to see me, lined up against a wall, of a hotel conference room, and they were like leaning on sticks and hobbling towards me with a stick as their support device when their leg was crushed or amputated. And just this scene, I really needed a while to recover just from the visual of how horrible these kids were, found themselves, and the suffering that they were going through. Once we got ourselves organized and sort of calmed down, I was so angry when I saw this. We interviewed a fairly large number of kids and their parents, and at the end of the day, settled on 14 families that either had a child killed or maimed. And 14 is a pretty large number, but we wanted a representative sample to be class representatives. So every one of these 14 children that I represent were either killed or maimed in a mining accident that is associated to either Glencore or Huaye, which sell to the five major tech companies that we have sued, because we were able to document that each of them are buying cobalt from the DRC from one or both of these companies. And the companies are Apple, Tesla, Dell, Microsoft, and Google.
This is so disturbing, even hearing you describe it. And I imagine there are families who have lost more than one child or had more than one child maimed.
Yes, absolutely. Several of the mothers that I interviewed had multiple children killed. Several of the families had a father killed, because there are some adults doing this mining as well. And all of the children, this is to me, we're going to hopefully talk about what some solutions are, but every one of the kids who was either killed or maimed had to drop out of school because the government imposed a $6 a month fee for children to attend school. And that drove thousands of kids out of the schools because they couldn't come up with $6 a month. So there's nothing else to do in this part of the world, in this part of the Congo, except mining. There are some other minerals that you can mine, but it's the cobalt right now that is hot, that is available as work. So the children gravitated to these cobalt sites and took up mining instead of school.
What's the youngest age that you've heard of a child going into the mines?
We have one boy who was 11 years old when he started mining, and then when he got severely injured, he was 14 years old. I asked that question of the group that I had there, and they said there are children younger than 11, but that they tend to be doing other things. You have to wash the cobalt rocks. You have to carry them, and there's loose rocks that are on the surface that someone younger could pick up. So I would say generally the kids mining start at 11, 12 years old, but there are younger children who are doing these other odd jobs on the mining sites.
And what are you seeking in the class action in terms of damages, and or are you asking for changes in practice?
Both of those. Certainly, we are looking for damages for these children who have been either killed or maimed. Their families were dependent on this measly dollar or so a day that they are paid, and so the families themselves are suffering horribly. And imagine what a terrible bind that is, puts a parent in. You can't pay the $6 a month school fee. You're so poor, and these people are desperately poor that they'll risk their lives for a dollar a day. But you're so poor, you can't afford that school fee, so you have to send your child off to work for a dollar, knowing that there's this huge risk. So we're seeking reparations for the families that have been devastated by these preventable mining accidents. That's step one. We're also, most important, I think, seeking a major change in how the mines operate. These mines could easily be regulated better, made safer for adult miners, and then the adult minors could be paid a decent wage so that they can support their families as adults and not rely on children doing the work. These are the companies we've sued are the wealthiest companies we've ever seen. They brag about their trillion-dollar companies. Apple, Tesla just became the highest stock value company in the world. These are filthy rich companies being run by spoiled, extremely wealthy people who have all the money they could ever dream of, and they could certainly afford to pay a bit more for the cobalt. Now, we're working with an economist to get us a pretty precise number, but to even multiply the wages by 10, 15 times would not make a noticeable dent in the price of a $1,000 iPhone. The amount of cobalt in each gadget is fairly small, except for the Tesla cars, where it's a major ingredient of the business model, which the irony of that just makes me crazy, that Tesla and Elon Musk are billing the company and these cars as the green future. We've done away with gas guzzlers, but they're built and powered by blood cobalt that is the most primitive form of mining right now that we've never seen. Sorry, I got a little off track, but yeah, we want to see an independent monitoring and certification system, regularize the mines, pay people more, and have this be a real job, not a life-threatening experience for everyone doing it. Those are the main things that we're seeking.
No, Terry, I think that if the general public knew of the dichotomy you've just outlined, they would be sickened. And that brings me to the so-called blood diamonds principle. You mentioned blood cobalt. What is the blood diamonds principle?
At some point, people who could afford to buy major diamonds, let's say, were told by activists who had started studying the supply chain of diamonds that a lot, if not most, of the diamonds were coming from conflict areas like Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, and the Congo, where the sales of the diamonds were paying for the weapons and the soldiers of the warring factions in these countries. So they developed a system to try to monitor, track where each diamond came from, and it was called the Kimberley Process, named after the city where the first meeting took place. But it was a monitoring protocol that was developed so that someone paying a lot of money for a diamond could do it sort of guilt-free, like this is not a blood diamond, this is a good diamond or a clean diamond. Sad to say, that whole system collapsed under corruption. It's not a reliable system, and I think most of the original participants would agree. But the concept is a good concept, that if you actually have a reliable monitoring system that could identify a so-called good product, that consumers who are paying lots of money for a product would prefer to have it be clean. And the gadgets we're talking about here, iPhones, all these other Google gadgets, and then, of course, a Tesla, which is extremely expensive, I think that if we can communicate out there to people that right now there's no question that those gadgets are powered by blood cobalt, and hopefully there would be a demand by them, the consumers, to fix the problem. And that's really one of the major things we're working on.
Terry, I think you would agree that in addition to bringing critical cases like the ones you've brought all of your career, in the courtroom, it's essential to have an on-the-ground public awareness people's movement to support that. What kind of support are you getting from, be it labor groups or youth groups, human rights organizations, in this momentous effort that you're launching?
Thank you. We absolutely agree that you need a parallel campaign public awareness program, but we have been very frustrated in the response that we've received so far. Labor groups, including the AFL-CIO and others, they've all condemned the blood cobalt. Everyone's aware of it and so on. But I'm afraid everyone's attention spans are so fractured right now that it's hard to get everyone to say, well, let's really focus on this. With the blood diamonds, I think the planets aligned nicely. There was a lot of funding for that effort, and that campaign worked. The solution did not. So we're trying to get the word out, and we've started now working with student groups, United Students Against Sweatshops, and so on, because I think that generation is addicted to their phones and other gadgets, and that generation probably cares a lot about this. We are posting pictures and trying to educate the public about the fact that in this year, 2020, for example, Black Lives Matter has really done an amazing job of energizing their movement, rightly so. But I'm trying to remind people that these children who are mining this cobalt, they are African children. They are virtual slaves mining this cobalt. So I'm a little frustrated that people aren't immediately viewing that as an important priority. But as I said, I think there's a lot going on right now, not to mention a pandemic, a president doing nothing about it, and the very important Black Lives Matter movement. But we're persistent, and we're going to continue to build our coalition and to get consumers to realize that all they need to do is tell these very wealthy companies that they're done with them until they can prove that they fixed this very horrible situation of blood cobalt.
The optics for these tech titans are not good. If you have the image of a maimed or dead child working for pennies to really run the phones that so much of the world relies on every day, I think it's an astonishing dichotomy.
It really is, because of the extremities that you are going from the gadgets of the future of the world to the most primitive mining situation on Earth. The juxtaposition is unfathomable, and it's time that people realized this in their own daily habits. I know people are frustrated, like, well, what can I do? Well, you got to do a bit more than click like on your social media, that you can take a moment. We have on our website, which is iradvocates.org, we have a call to action where we provide the Twitter and some emails of the executives that are running the companies we've sued, and just ask people to directly contact them. Take a minute. Don't just click like. Take a minute and say, I'm very concerned about this, so that we can build consumer concern with each company that is participating in this horrible practice.
Well, I will definitely be sharing that link with all of my contacts. Terry, you have brought really some of the most significant cases against giant multinational corporations. How does this case compare to some of your prior cases?
Well, this case is, the facts are firstly, as we've been talking about, just horrible. But this case I'm very excited about as a lawyer. I take off my activist hat. As a lawyer, we are using for the first time a relatively new statute called the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. And it was designed, I think, doesn't matter why, but I think it was designed mainly for sex trafficking concerns, and it had a lot of Republican support because they were, and their Christian or religious bases, really were horrified about the facts of sex trafficking. So this statute, though, was written broadly enough to cover anyone who is trafficked or forced to work. It has a very, very favorable language that allows us to sue a company or a person that knowingly benefits from forced labor. So usually these companies, if it's a supply chain issue, they come in and say, well, we're just buying cobalt. We don't control it. It's not us that is doing the mining and so on. But with this statute, we have to show that they've knowingly benefited from this supply chain venture. Venture is the operative word. So I'm very excited to see how this goes. I think we have a new tool here that could really be a breakthrough. and using it in this context with the horrible facts is probably going to give us something we can work with in the future in other situations like this.
Mm. This is really something that we on Law and Disorder want to follow as you wind your way through the courts. And procedurally, Terry, what's next?
We just filed last Friday, the 26th of June, an amended complaint. There were many developments in the Cobalt area that I wanted to put into the complaint. For example, Tesla bought a major portion of Glencore, the mining company. That's probably a game changer for Tesla's liability here. We don't know the details of it. There were also developments in other reporting that clearly puts all of the companies on notice of what's happening in their supply chains. And then I also had additional details about why the children were forced to work. We were concerned that the companies were going to simply argue that no one made the kids work. They just showed up and started working. So we added facts that we knew to show that most of the children were brought to these sites or directed to the mining sites by these labor brokers that were associated with the mining companies. So those are among the facts that we added. And our new complaint, the amended version, is on our website, iradvocates.org. And there are quite a few photos of the children that we represent, as well as the mining sites, that will add some color to this discussion. For the children, we didn't include their faces, obviously. They are anonymous plaintiffs. They were worried about retaliation. But the new complaint, I think, tells the full story now, and the next steps will be the companies will be responding to the complaint.
It's heartening to know that you were able to amend the complaint. Kudos to you for the amazing work that you continue to do on behalf of human rights.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased that I'm able to take some lawyer skills and combine them with campaign skills and try to bring these issues to the public's attention, and most important, to try to force these companies to change their practices. It is most unfortunate that the richest companies on earth are so far showing themselves indifferent to the plight of these children, and they're taking a head-in-the-sand approach. So we're going to put the facts right in their face and make them deal with their reality.
Best of luck to you. We will be following this case closely, and we hope to have you back on at the next victory on your behalf.
Well, thank you so much for your interest, and I will definitely keep you advised of our progress.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder, and we'll talk again.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The Chinese word for crisis consists of two characters. One means danger, the other means opportunity. We currently are in an historically unprecedented situation fraught with both danger and opportunity. The great Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin once remarked that sometimes nothing happens in decades, and other times decades happen in a few weeks. This is our situation now. We see an American spring unfolding. The public lynching of George Floyd has triggered massive outpourings in several thousands of American cities, both large and small. Black Lives Matter is supported by a majority of Americans, including a majority of whites. This kind of broad solidarity was absent during the time of Martin Luther King. The demonstrations are in large part led by people of color, mostly young people. Elected officials and traditional civil rights leaders are not leading the current uprising. As the LA Progressive has written, the gross underlying inequality, racially and more broadly economically, affects every aspect of life in the U.S. and is the root cause of the volcanic anger erupting against the veneer of obsolete institutions. We speak today with Glenn Ford, the editor of the prestigious Black Agenda Report, about the unfolding movement, where it came from, and where it might be heading. Ford founded the Black Agenda Report and has edited it since 2006. He was a founding member of the Washington chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, and he has spoken at scores of colleges and universities. Glenn Ford, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Let's talk about the position of many politicians that police reforms like wearing of body cameras or more training or the outlawing of chokeholds, that this will curb police abuse. What's your view on these reforms? Will they really curb police abuse?
Well, of course, we all are in favor in principle with most of those reforms, but understand what these politicians are doing is protecting the police, protecting them by getting rid of those behaviors and policies that have come under the greatest attack. But they're not going to be cooperative in any demand for reallocation of power, that is, to make the police truly accountable. They use that word all the time, accountability, but accountability is a power relationship, and that they don't want to tamper with.
So how do you appreciate the demand to abolish the police? Angela Davis has articulated that. Critics respond that we'll be unsafe if we abolish the police. Would we?
Well, we don't just abolish the police. We replace the police. And in the interim, between the actual physical replacement of the police, you exercise decisive power over not just what they do day to day, that is, overseeing them to see that they don't commit excessive infractions, which is what oversight seems to be these days, but you shape what policing is in America. That means, in fact, that most of the cops who presently are on the job have been mistrained, have joined the police force for all the worst reasons, and will have to be replaced. So this is a huge undertaking that requires real, not just community input, but community mobilization for the power to reshape the police so that we don't even call them police anymore. It requires that the people take part in their own security. That is a tremendous popular mobilization project that has to go along with the demands. So, no, you don't just get rid of the police overnight. There would be a huge backlash if that ever happened, and it won't. But if it ever did, there'd be a huge backlash from the Black community itself, because the security problem, and everyone has security concerns all over the world, the security question would not be addressed. But we must address that security question. And so it's fine and necessary to state the principle and the long-range goal of disbanding the police, but that demand itself calls forth a whole arena of work and study to find out what kind of work we should be doing. The project cries out to be filled out.
So what's the role, I mean the real role, apart from they say that they're keeping us safe, I don't believe that. What's the real role of the police in our class society?
Oh, it's the protection of property and privilege. And in a racist society, that means white property, oligarch's property, and white privilege. That has been their function the entire time. They have not stepped away from that imperative. In fact, they've doubled down, which is what militarization of the police. federal intervention in policing, which was always marketed as a kind of reform. People had it in their heads, and they were encouraged to think that this kind of reform would get rid of, make passé and obsolete the Dodge Sheriff figure, you know, the pot-bellied Dodge Sheriff, Southern, of course, who lorded it over black folks and called on his good old boys to help to reinforce him if they thought black folks got out of line. Everybody wanted to get rid of that. But the real result of federal intervention beginning in 1968 with the passage of the LEAA, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration Bill. That federal intervention and all the rest that have followed under the mass black incarceration regime have, in fact, made the imperative of keeping black folks in line, protecting white privilege and property even more intense, more fatal, much more like a police state. In fact, when you talk about the United States, it's not like a police state. It is the archetype of a police state in the modern capitalist world.
So how would you ensure public safety if the police are abolished?
Well, just as the Black Panther Party proposed back in 68, 69, the people should police themselves or choose the instruments of their own security. That is a self-determination question. It's a question of democracy. And the immediate answer in today to that question is community control of police. And in Chicago, they have by far the most developed community control of police campaign in the whole country. They've had a bill for community control of the police since 2012, I believe, and through some wonderful redirection of street protest power into an intervention in the electoral system. Now in Chicago, 19 of the 50 city councilmen, board of aldermen, now support community control of the police. The mayor, the new black woman mayor, of course, is a longtime friend and supporter of the Chicago police. And she's the biggest impediment at the moment. So people ought to be looking at what's been happening in Chicago. They've been wrestling with this question for a very, very long time, inspired by the police state murder of Fred Hampton. The best analysis can be found there.
The mayor promised when she was running for office that she would be active in doing this, and yet she's not done a thing, not a single thing. Meanwhile, they've got a bill up in front of city council to provide for an elected community group that would monitor the police. I mean, that would be real community control of the police. So we'll see how that fares. Are you aware of what they're doing with that bill, Glenn?
Sure. That's the CPAC bill. That's the current iteration of the bill that was put together, as I said, back in 2012. And they've been pushing it ever since. What the mayor says, as she retreated from her campaign position, she now says that defunding of the police, that's not community control, but that defunding of the police is a bad thing because it would result in the laying off of minority police. Who have less seniority. She's hiding behind the color issue in order, in fact, to protect the police.
Yeah, it reminds me of the saying that if you got a boot on your neck, it doesn't matter whether there's a brown foot inside of the boot.
If the police are an army of occupation in the black community, the color of the soldiers in that army is not really that important. What's important is the mission of that army of occupation, and that mission is to terrorize, pacify, and contain all of the black community. And that is, in fact, the general principle of the mass black incarceration regime that was imposed in the late 60s as a reaction to the black rebellions of that decade.
What is the position, Glenn Ford, of the Democratic Party respecting police abuse? I read recently that Joe Biden suggested that people be shot in the legs rather than in the chest.
Mass black incarceration, the creation of a militarized police state has always been a thoroughly bipartisan affair. With the imposition of the mass black incarceration regime, first with measures that came under the umbrella of the drug war back in 68-69. Well, the LEAA, which I explained earlier, was key to that, and that was introduced under the Johnson administration. The Crime Bill of 1994 was, of course, a creation of the Bill Clinton administration, an administration in which Joe Biden was deeply involved, and he claims, I don't know if it's really true, but he claims that he wrote the bill. So this is a bipartisan scheme to continue the containment and terrorization of and criminalization of the black community, and Joe Biden's hands are bloodier than most.
Malik Mia has written in Green Left Weekly that the demand to abolish the current police force is step one. Community control, independent prosecutors, and the creation of a safety force must follow to revolutionize policing. Can you elaborate on that, please?
No, that's a little bit backwards, and activists can argue about it. But, of course, it's backwards. You're not going to abolish a police department and then get community control. It really doesn't work that way. As others have pointed out, if there is a vacuum under capitalism in security for property, then the people with property are going to buy their security. If the public's not going to provide the policing that the oligarchs want, then the oligarchs and even white neighborhood associations will then contract with private security firms. And we know this will occur. We saw it in New Orleans with Katrina. As soon as there was no effective police because the police were either stranded or had left town themselves, then we saw this huge influx of private security firms, including not just Blackwater, the villainous mercenary outfit based in the U.S., but Israeli security firms, all of them descending on New Orleans. You would have that kind of situation if you willy-nilly disbanded before establishing black community control or community control. That's what you'd see. But that's not going to happen. If it did happen, however, you'd have almost the worst of all possible worlds with these private mercenaries now stalking and acting in predatory fashion in the black community.
Elected officials and traditional civil rights leaders are not leading the current uprising. New young leaders, many of them people of color, have stepped up. How do you appreciate that phenomena?
Well, almost all the elected leaders of the black community are, of course, Democrats, and they take their orders from the Democratic Party and from Nancy Pelosi. So we saw the farcical spectacle of Nancy Pelosi surrounded by her minions in the Congressional Black Caucus, putting on kente cloth and taking a knee in the Capitol grounds in some kind of symbolic act of solidarity. But we have to talk about who that was surrounding Nancy Pelosi. In 2014, 2 months before Michael Brown was shot down in Ferguson, Missouri, the Grayson Amendment was on the House floor. The Grayson Amendment would have halted, abolished the Pentagon's 1033 program. The 1033 program is the federal program, the main one, for militarization of the police. It funnels billions of dollars in military weapons and gear and sometimes training to local police departments. and it was up for a vote. In that vote, 30 members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to keep the 1033 program going. Only 8 voted against it. That means 80% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to continue the militarization of the police. That included William Clay, who was Michael Brown's congressman, Michael Brown being the young man shot down in Ferguson, Missouri in August of 2014, setting off what came to be called the Black Lives Matter movement. But those same Congressional Black Caucus members, having gone through the first iteration of the Black Lives Matter movement, seemed to have learned nothing, nothing at all. It was as if the movement never existed, because in 2018, 75% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to make the police a protected class, that is, protected like people of color are protected under the law, and voted an assault against police should be a federal hate crime. Of course, you know, everybody knows that when the police kick your butt, they always charge you with assault. So now you'll be eligible for another 5 years in prison for committing a federal hate crime because the cops charged you with assault. But this is what that Congressional Black Caucus does, and they have the nerve to bend the knee and kneel along with their boss lady as if they are in solidarity with any movement against the police.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. Our guest today is Glenn Ford, the founder and editor of Black Agenda Report. The Democrats in both the House and the Senate oppose the demand to defund or especially abolish the police. They place their hopes in electing Joe Biden. What would that mean for Black Lives Matter if Joe Biden is elected?
Oh, you know, people speculate. The left speculates about this all the time, whether it's better for the movement if a right-wing racist Republican is in power or if a Democrat is in power. And lots of my friends say that, well, it's better when Democrats are in power because then they have to face up to and defend the status quo rather than when they're out of power, pretend that they're not defenders of the status quo. I really don't like to engage in that kind of speculation because usually it's engaged in as an excuse to drop everything and vote for the Democrat, whoever that is. And I see no value in getting involved in that.
Do you think that the movement should focus on the election, or do you believe that social change comes from someplace else, from below?
Well, we already saw that it comes from somewhere else, from below. We had hundreds of thousands of people in the streets in the George Floyd protests. Those protests and occupations still continue. And we saw the reaction of the ruling class. You can see what the ruling class's reaction is through the reaction of their media. That's the ruling class media. And through the reaction of the corporate duopoly. And so they all basically folded or pretended to fold to these demands, but not in substance. That is, they conceded that police brutality, yes, does exist, that it is directed disproportionately at Black people, and that the problem is systemic. That they have finally accepted. In fact, it's now part of their regular spiel, and they've enlisted all their corporate people, and they're giving lots of money to Black Lives Matter and all kinds of other organizations in order to pretend that they're down with systemic change. But what they're really trying to do, of course, is to blunt the change, to say we have been now convinced now by you that there is a problem, therefore you can leave it up to us to solve. By doing that, they hope to blunt any empowerment demands, which is what the next order of the day, like community control of police. They want you to leave the solution in their hands because they've been converted. They're born again. They're on your side.
We're speaking with Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report. Glenn, social consciousness and confidence, especially among youth, is growing. Participation in the mass movement has caused that. Beyond police abolition, what other demands do you anticipate are going to come to the fore?
All of them will come to the fore. You know, I think, and I can't prove it, but I'm sure of it, the huge white participation, young white people especially, in this round of protests, and in fact, they numerically dominated in lots of places. You know, there were protests everywhere in the United States, including places where there were very few black people. There are only 14 Black Lives Matter chapters in the United States. Most big cities don't have one. And yet demonstrations, protests of all kinds were everywhere with the participation of huge numbers of white kids. And I think that is a direct result of Bernie Sanders being forced out or bowing out of his race for the Democratic presidential nomination. That race, beginning in 2016 and continuing this year, had raised the expectations of millions of young people of the possibility of making some kind of important changes in the United States through the electoral process. But the nonstop 24/7 beatdown that the corporate media and the Democratic Party inflicted on Bernie, resulting finally in him bowing out and scurrying over into the Biden camp and acting like we're all in this together, I think that caused millions of his young white supporters to say, no, street is where it's at. I think those kids, many of them, wanted to be in the streets even as they supported Bernie, but they didn't want to embarrass the candidate. Well, he unleashed them and freed them when he bowed out. I think that is responsible for much of the disproportionate, in terms of black-led movements, white participation.
Glenn, we've got time, unfortunately, for only two more questions. And I wanted to ask you the penultimate question. Malcolm X profoundly understood that, as he put it, you can't have capitalism without racism. Do you think more and more people are making that connection?
Yeah, and we're seeing more and more people using the term racial capitalism, as if it's one word, in fact, racial capitalism. There is a question whether capitalism, in theory, can work without racism. But that's not how capitalism developed in the United States in particular, but it applies to all of the imperial countries. The United States would not be the United States, would not have been able to produce all that capital from the super, super, super exploitation of slaves and become, before the turn of the 20th century, a major world economic power. In 1850, 10 years before the Civil War, the value, market value of slaves was the biggest asset of the United States, bigger than every other asset, all the railroads, all the industries, everything else except the land of the United States itself. And that the land of those slave states was, in fact, overvalued. It was valuable only because it was worked by slaves. So this capitalism has always been racial, and Britain would not be the position of the center of world capital until overtaken by the United States, except for its super exploitation, people in India and Africa and elsewhere in the world. So capitalism's always been racial, and it's only theoretical whether it could exist otherwise.
Glenn, how can people contact Black Agenda Report and follow your work?
Well, they can go to Black Agenda Report easily and see a new issue every Wednesday by visiting blackagendareport.com. But all of our editors, me included, we all list our email addresses at the bottom of each story that we write, so you can also contact us directly.
Thanks, Glenn. One last question before we have to say goodbye. People will be listening to this program the week of the 4th of July. And my last question for you is, what does the 4th of July mean to you?
Oh, you know, you made an easy one there. All you have to do, the best statement on the 4th of July ever, never to be surpassed, was Frederick Douglass's speech on what is the 4th of July to me, delivered in, I believe, Rochester, New York, in the 1850s. It reams the United States out with the most artistic, if that's the right word, language ever employed against a villain.
He was an eloquent man. Glenn Ford, it's great to have you on Law & Disorder. Keep up your good work on Black Agenda Report, and we're sure to have you back as a guest in the near future. You take it easy, Glenn Ford, and thank you so much.
Thank you, brother. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.